Thank you. Governor Ricketts, you have 3% unemployment in Nebraska. You just signed, I think, a $400-some million trade bill with Taiwan. Talk a little bit. You're quite different with your issues than Governor Hogan is, and I suspect Governor Bevins. Talk a little bit more of what you're doing there in Nebraska with 3% unemployment. Doesn't sound the same as necessary job creation as some other states that are hurting. But what's happening out there, and why is it so successful?
Well, what we are trying to do, and which I think all of us as governors, our goal is to help our states grow. How do we create more and better paying jobs? How do we keep our kids and grandkids in our states? How do we attract people to come to our states? And with 3% unemployment, we've got different challenges. So for example, one of the things we did is we changed our unemployment system into a reemployment system. And by that I mean is everybody who's applying for those benefits sits down with a jobs coach first and creates a resume. And not only has that resume to go out and look for a job, but that resume is now searchable online so that companies can proactively reach out and say, hey, you've got the skills I need, would you take a look at this job? So that's one of the ways we've been innovative, trying to connect job seekers with the employers who have those jobs. And it's also important that, you know, we're providing a higher level service. We're, because of the way the US government collects the data, we don't have the data yet to show that the people are actually spending less time on those benefits, that they're getting jobs faster. We hope to be able to collect that data. But that's important because the one of the things we know is the longer that you're on unemployed, the more your job skills degrade. So we've got to try and get you back into the workforce as quickly as possible. But one of the things we do know that even though in the first 5 months of this year, we've taken our benefits up about $12 a week, $12 a month, so we've increased the amount of benefits, and our unemployment rate has actually ticked up from 2.8% to 3%, we actually have reduced the amount of benefits we're paying out by $6.7 million. And it's so about 15%. At the same time, across the country on average, benefits paying out have gone up about 1.2% or about $172 million. So while we don't have quite all the data we'd like to show that this is actually helping people get back to work faster and being innovative how we connect people, that's one of the things we're doing. And that's really one of our challenges in Nebraska. I said better paying jobs, our average wage is actually below the national average. So we're trying to think about how we improve that statistic. And just in general, and this applies to everything, including our reemployment program, how do we do a better job of delivering services? I believe that's why the people of Nebraska hired me, to bring my private sector experience to making government more effective, more efficient, more customer focused. And by doing that, we will actually help the job creators out there do a better job. I mean, Nebraska right now, Forbes last year ranked us the third best state to do business. CNN ranked us number 7. So we are trying to work on developing a culture in state government that we are working to help create those jobs with businesses so that they can expand and help hire more Nebraskans and ultimately help companies expand in Nebraska, draw more people to Nebraska. Because at the end of the day, we've got to hold on to our young people and draw more people to our state because of that 3% unemployment rate.
I'm struck with your comments earlier that we should watch who Trump surrounds himself with. I would nominate you for U.S. Department of Trade. I think Bill Brock is here, a former trade representative, with your trade deal with Taiwan. Mr. Trump.
Well, thanks. I got the best job in the world right now.
I don't think Mr. Trump is pro-trade right now, so good luck influencing him. Governor Bevins. Not last or least, you pointed out how new you are in your job, and yet I know that you saved the Kentucky underfunded pension plan so far and paying down Kentucky debt. You're also reforming the criminal justice system. You're really off to a fast start. Do you want to talk a little bit about those?
Sure. I mean, thank you. I mean, we are off to a fast start, and in some measure, I don't see this as a game. And I encourage you, as it relates to this electoral process, as it relates to things that are happening both federally as well as in your respective states, politics is not a game. It's not R's versus D's with an occasional I sprinkled in. This is real stuff. And while we happen to be Republicans, and I was elected as a Republican, the reality is I'm responsible for all the constituents in Kentucky. And there are far more Democrats than Republicans in our state. And so that what I have focused on with a sense of urgency and a sense of conviction, because truth be told, I've never been in elected office like others on this stage prior to being governor. I didn't aspire to this. I didn't study political science. This wasn't something I wanted to do. I became weary of paying taxes and seeing them get wasted, seeing them being redistributed and reallocated by people who, frankly, had no comprehension whatsoever as to how the wealth of this nation has been created and is continuing to be created. And yet, I have a divided House and Senate. I have a speaker who's suing me, an attorney general who's suing me, other Democrats who are suing me. So obviously this is not a friendly environment. They think they're going to wear me out. They did this to the last Republican governor we had. They sued him literally right out of town. And I grew up poor in the country. That does, you know, bullies don't work well with poor kids from the country. So I will say this, though. Knowing, though, you know, that if you chase two rabbits, you don't catch either one of them. The same with 100 rabbits. And that, so that to that end, you got to be smart. You got to pick your battles. What is it that you're going to work on? I did not, in this effort, knowing how difficult it would be to pass a budget, for example, and with everybody betting that we would not be able to, and you look at poor Governor Rauner in Illinois and how Madigan's playing him and how they're basically holding that hostage, they tried the same thing with me. And long story short, I had to take away the sticks and leave in the carrots. So while it would have been good to remove, for example, the inventory tax as a state that is the hub of manufacturing in America on many fronts, and yet we're one of two states with an inventory tax, had that been in there, do you think that all the headlines would have been, you know, helping the rich? Of course they would have. So you don't, you got to pick your battles. So some of the things that we have focused on with a sense of urgency have been shoring up the pension system. We put $1.2 billion into our failing pension systems. They're a long way from being shored up, but it was more money than has ever been put forward. You think that the teachers' unions who worked so hard against me were not secretly happy for this? And trust me, next time they're asked to wade in, it will be a don't ask, don't tell for them as well. They're grateful that somebody for the first time is stepping up and addressing something that was a concern to them. I focused on things like programs like Fostering Success, implemented, pioneered something for how we have all these hundreds and thousands of young people in our states who at the age of 18 are coming out of the foster system and being dumped out into society with no backbone or no back bench of support, I should say. And these poor kids are lost. They've never had a family. They have no support network. They now have nothing. And they statistically are vulnerable. And these young women are going to get pregnant early. These young men are going to, and women alike, are going to invariably end up on the wrong track and end up in prison at high proportions. So what are we doing about that? This isn't a Republican or a Democrat issue. And so we set up a program where we literally brought these students that were between the ages of 18 and 23, not students but young people, who had aged out of the foster system were now on their own, and we did two things. We created an employment program both with the state government and with private employers who brought them on board with a 10-week program where they were given jobs where they were paid $10 an hour and they were taught how to show up on time and how to dress, and we gave them financial literacy courses and we gave them opportunities. More than 60% of these kids have now gotten full-time employment as a result of this. There was a second part to this. We brought families, reached out to families like us, and said, would you be willing to be a mentor to these kids? Would you be willing to take one of these young people with no legal or financial obligation, but a willingness to be a mentor and to help them? Would you be willing to come alongside these young people, invite them to your house on Thanksgiving, help them to figure out how to fill out a job application, help them decide between two choices that they have to make, whatever the case may be? We hoped for a couple of dozen. We worked with an organization, Orphan Care Alliance, and some others to create training programs for the couple dozen families we hoped would sign up. We've had hundreds. It's going to transform our state. I introduced something called the Red Tape Reduction Initiative. If you want to learn more about it, go to redtapereduction.com. I encourage every state, red, blue, and otherwise, to do the exact same thing. We have more than 4,500 pieces of regulation that affect business in our state. And I'm quite confident that we can thoroughly regulate business with, say, 3,000. And so to that end, I literally have committed to the fact. I've noticed most of the laughing's over on this side. I don't know if that's it. But in all seriousness, I mean, I'm committed to, and I've said publicly, we are going to remove one-third of the red tape in Kentucky that affects business in the next 3 years, and we will do it. You watch Kentucky move. We will get that done. These are the types of things that I've been moving on. You know, this and expungement. We passed an expungement bill. We are leading on the fact that we have a tremendous divide in our nation. And again, we talk about it politically. I encourage you to ask yourselves, and I appreciate that there's young people here too. For those of you who have brought young people here, you have children, you have grandchildren, whether they're here or not. Why are you here? Why are you here? Why do you care about this? And how badly do you care? Because there is a divide, and it's more than anecdotal. There is a divide in America, ideologically, you know, financially and otherwise. And we are becoming fragmented. And the fabric of America and the many threads that comprise that fabric are being shredded one at a time. And they're being pulled out, and that fabric is being twisted and torn. And we have individually and responsibly, collectively, a responsibility to fix this. We do. And so, frankly, we have this recidivism with our prisons. We have people who make bad choices, increasingly drug-related, when they're young, and they get on a track where they're basically screwed for the rest of their life. And we, as a responsible government, have a responsibility to find a way to find solutions to that. And so we passed an expungement bill that gives people for nonviolent felonies, for people where there is no victim, where restitution has been paid, where service, you know, where their prison terms have been served, to have the ability to have their rights restored to them, to have their ability to not have to check a box saying they're a felon, so that they can become integrated and become a part of society again. And these things matter. These are not R things or D things. It confuses all the D's in my state when I'm leading on these things, because these are things they've given lip service to. But lip service, we are at a point in America where we have got to stop blowing smoke and giving patronage to things, and we've got to start electing men and women who will actually lead with a sense of purpose and a sense of conviction and with a sense of urgency and put their feet on the gas. These are just a handful of the things that we've gotten done in 7 months. And I've done it with not the most greatest amount of support from the other side, but we've done it because we've used the power of social media and the bully pulpit that we have as governors to shame people into disagreeing with the logic of these things. And while we are a society that increasingly does not have much shame left, as is evidenced on many fronts, nonetheless, there is still the ability to use shame effectively, and I don't think that we as governors should fail to appreciate the power of that. So these are just some of the things that we're working on. In addition to that, we are working on, you know, school choice. We're working on pension reform, tax reform, and other things. These things shall pass. I will say this. I'm not going to brag like these guys do, but I will say this. I will say this. You watch Kentucky go. Just watch Kentucky. You think our horses run fast. You think our horses run fast. You watch our economy in the next 4 years.
Governor, I know everything you said is true. And as you said to Governor Hogan, it's all right to brag when it's all true. So thank you. Governor
Ricketts. Let me just say, I know he has the Kentucky Derby, but I'm the only one that crowned a Triple Crown winner.
Yeah, thank you.
And it's now at stud in Kentucky, I'll say.
Well, you can tell the Republican governors the competition is fierce in this market economy. Governor Ricketts, you were talking to me earlier, and this is on a different note, about your traveling with your daughters to look at colleges and the like. And that led to a discussion about what our young people know, other than the show Hamilton. Hamlet maybe is another one, but anyway, Hamilton, about our founding fathers, about America. You're in the heartland for sure. Do you want to comment a little bit on that? Because this may lead us into a final round here on what is our theme, which is the beyond. So beyond all this, what about America?
Yeah, we were talking about Hamilton, which I think is something that has been fantastic for our young people to find out more about our founders, because I don't think with what has happened in education, we have certainly gotten away from civics. I can recall when my daughter was in fourth grade, they had stopped teaching the state capitals in her school. I couldn't believe it, so I called up my State Board of Education representative and yelled at him, and he got it put back in the curriculum. But, you know, that's crazy. And so I think Hamilton actually has been great, because I've got two teenage daughters. They love the musical. And when we went looking at colleges for my older daughter, we went to Boston and we went to Virginia, and they were fascinated about the history. My daughter wanted to go to Monticello and see where Thomas Jefferson lived. She wanted to go at the, you know, battle site of Yorktown to see the British fort that Alexander Hamilton had taken as a lieutenant colonel. So, you know, things like that I think are really actually great. Because, you know, things like Hamilton can be one of those things that helps inspire. And I think it really also says a couple of things about how we have to rethink education. That education, we are basically teaching our kids the same way we did 100 years ago. And that's not a way to be successful. We've got to challenge our educators to rethink how they deliver that, leveraging technology that's impacting every other industry to be able to do a better job of how we deliver that. And thinking outside the box, like maybe musicals like Hamilton, about how we engage young people to start learning more about our history, how we make it interesting for them. They're very different from the way that I grew up, you know, with regard to how we thought about things and learned about things. So, and frankly, if you look at it in a situation where it's true everywhere, you know, you've got taxes that are already high. People are already feeling the burden of that. They're not interested in spending more in taxes. I think to, you know, Matt's point, people don't want no government. They want government works, and they're frustrated because government hasn't been working. So that's our job to try and make government work. But we need to think about how we're rethinking the same way we're rethinking how we deliver services. We need to rethink the way that we're delivering education so that we can be competitive going into this 21st century. Because I can tell you right now, we are putting a lot of money into education. We're not getting the returns back out of it. We've got to rethink how this works. And just like every other industry, we got to do a better job of providing those services and bring our costs down at the same time.
Thank you. All of you can comment, but I'll start with Governor Hogan. How do you all balance, and how will you balance, public policy needs with cutting taxes and cutting spending? You just said a lot of money is going to education. I'm sure much is wasted, but nonetheless, how are you going to balance that going forward, Governor?
Well, what we found was that by cutting taxes, we actually increased revenues because, as I mentioned, we've been growing jobs at a much faster rate. Instead of losing 200,000 jobs, we created 74,000 since I've been governor. So we have 74,000 new people paying income taxes. We have businesses that are being successful that are now paying more taxes. So even though we cut some wasteful spending and shrunk a little bit of the size of government, we cut taxes, we actually had more money to deal with. And so we didn't have to make any drastic cuts to any agencies. We didn't have to hurt any important programs. We put $6.3 billion into education. 2 years in a row, I had record funding for education. We had an unprecedented, we just put $2 billion into infrastructure projects in our state to fix every single structurally deficient bridge in the state and to move forward on the top priority road and the transit projects in every single jurisdiction in the entire state, things that people have been waiting for a decade. So I think if you run the government more efficiently and more cost-effectively, and you can get your economy stimulated, you don't have to be worried about a lack of revenues. You can actually bring in more money just like you can in a business.
You all agree.
Exactly.
Well, I was going to say, I think one of the important things, though, is also thinking about the expense control side. And I think your point about not cutting agencies, real expense control is not walking in and saying, oh, I'm slashing this and slashing that. Certainly, if there's wasteful programs, you don't want to keep them. You want to get rid of them. But real expense control is about process improvement, continuous process improvement every day. How do you figure out, how do you leverage processes, better technology to deliver those services and bring your costs down at the same time? Let me give you an example in Nebraska, which kind of get your comment about the Democrats being surprised is kind of goes to this one. So we have a system called Access Nebraska. It's how people apply for economic assistance. And we were doing a really, really bad job. In August of 2014, before I took over, it was taking us nearly 24 minutes to answer the phone. Now think about that. Say you're a low-income person, you've got a prepaid phone with 45 minutes on it, and you just spent half that time waiting on hold just to talk to somebody. How does that make you feel? What does that do to your quality of life? That's just bad service. So by focusing on things such as process improvement, and by that I mean picking up the mail at 2 in the morning instead of 9 in the morning, so it all could be opened and scanned and ready to go at 8 o'clock when the call center people showed up, we've been able to take that on hold time down from that 24 minutes. And every month this year so far, we've been at our goal of 5 minutes or less. And not only are we answering the phone faster, our accuracy rate has improved. So now we're actually doing a better job making the people who are getting the benefits or people who deserve the benefits. We have taken the time it takes to process a SNAP application down from 40 days down to 10 days, and you don't think that makes a difference in somebody's quality of life? We've gone from a national rank of 48 out of 53 down to 27, and not that anybody's proud of being middle of the pack. It does show significant improvements in something less than 20 months. And also importantly, the federal government was planning on, because we were doing such a bad job, the federal government was going to yank $17 million of our funding, which means we at the state would have had to pick that up. So, but by improving and doing a better job of delivering our services, we actually have saved the state of Nebraska, our taxpayers, $17 million. So that's how you deliver, again, process improvement to do a better job of delivering services and bringing your cost down at the same time. We've done it for our counties. We've consolidated all those servers they had in their courthouses, 90 of them into our state data centers. We've improved their reliability, we've improved their uptime, and we've reduced their network costs by 20%, saving those county taxpayers' dollars. So this is how you get that cost saving. So when you're looking at how do I affect tax relief, well, it's just like in a business, control your expenses, let your revenues grow, and then you've got that room for tax relief to be able to start pulling that back in. So it's not about coming in and, you know, if you went to your customers in the private sector and said, hey, I'm going to reduce the price I'm going to charge you, but I'm also going to take away all these things you like about my service, well, you'd go out of business. Your customers wouldn't stand for it. Well, we shouldn't think about running government, you know, that way. We should, you know, in the way that we're just going to take things away. We've got to deliver those services. People depend upon us. So we've got to figure out how we can do a better job of delivering those services and bring our costs down, just like in the private sector. And again, that's where that culture change is coming in that we're trying to affect. So we make, you know, long after I'm gone, people are thinking this way in state government about how do we affect continuous improvement so that whatever, you know, we've been able to accomplish, they can build upon that and do an even better job in the future. That's ultimately how you drive down your ability, you know, those expenses and get tax relief.
I know we're going to go to questions in a minute, but let me just have more on a personal note. And Governor Bivens, I think you want to address
I want to address something real quickly, because actually, I mean, it's interesting. You got to cut the fat in government. If you don't think there's any, you haven't been following along, because I'll tell you, one of the things we did, we cut 9% out of our state budget. And there was crying and weeping and gnashing of teeth, but truth be told, it wasn't that hard. And we exempted K-12 education, we exempted veterans, we exempted Medicaid, but all the other things we've cut, and nobody's missed it, truth be told. We're more efficient, we're more effective. The reality is we have an obligation to be good stewards of your money. I've often asked this question, how many of you in this room ever had to buy your own bicycle? Okay, a handful of you. How many of you left that bicycle out in the rain? I mean, seriously, none of you. And we need to start as governors being better stewards of your money and our own money as taxpayers. But I want to touch on something you said, Ann, about education. You know, Thomas, we talk about history and the importance of things. How many of you think it would be a good idea that if we required a high school student graduating from high school in our country to know as much as somebody who's passing a test to become a first-time citizen? 100 questions. How many people think that's a good idea? I mean, I'll tell you what, it's what people like Doug Ducey is doing right now in Arizona, and it's something that's going to be done in Kentucky. It's a fantastic idea. These are the types of ways it's our responsibility to use the positions of influence that we have. But I want to touch on something real fast. Why do we even spend our money on public education? What is the purpose of using tax dollars for public education? It is to do, as Thomas Jefferson said, it is for the purpose of creating virtuous citizens. What is a virtuous citizen? It's not a goody-goody. It's not somebody who's holier than the next person. A virtuous citizen, work is a virtue. Being productive is a virtue. Being an integral part of your community, that is a virtue. We have an obligation in our states and in our nation to educate our young people, and that does not simply mean getting a 4-year post-secondary degree that may or may not have any value, and you incur tens of thousands of dollars for it, and there's no outlet for it at the other end. We owe better than this to young people. And one of the things that I've pushed forward is we created a $100 million over the next 2 years workforce development pool where to apply for this money, it's required. Requiring our post-secondary schools, vocational schools, technical schools, and our 4-year institutions, as well as a local high school, as well as local business, to work together to come up with a proposal where the three of them agree this is a need in our community. And we have got an obligation to stop assuming that every kid needs to go get a 4-year degree immediately and that they're somehow going to be made better for that, because we are misleading them and we are screwing America in the process.
Thank you. We're running a little late, but let's take some questions. We have some microphones out in the audience, so if I can see some hands here somewhere.
There's one in the back there.
Is the one in the back? Go ahead, please. Thank you.
My name's Larry Gelman. I'm from Tucson, Arizona. And as Ann pointed...
Doug, get ready to answer this one. This guy's from Arizona.
I've already asked him. As Ann pointed out, Republicans are doing an amazing job of dominating elections on the state level with governorships and state legislatures. And yet we're now in the midst of our third straight election where the Republicans have seemingly been unable to put forth a candidate that most Americans resonate to. My question is, why do you think that is, and what do you think the Republican Party needs to do better in order to change that?
Do you want to direct? I'll start with Governor Hogan, and we'll go across.
Well, it's an excellent question, and I'm not sure there's an easy answer for it. But, you know, I mentioned earlier, I'm a guy in the bluest state in the country, second time in 50 years. We have 26% of the vote is Republican. I managed to find a way to talk about issues that appealed to a majority of the people in our state, and we focused on the things that people cared about. So I actually got more votes from Democrats and independents than I did from Republicans. We weren't supposed to win the race. Everybody predicted we were going to get blown out by 18 to 24 points. We ended up winning 20 out of 23 counties by 35 percentage points. And it's because we talked about the things that Democrats agreed with, that independents agreed with. We've got to find a way in our Republican Party to reach more people. And I think both parties are actually guilty of this. And I'm somewhat frustrated with national politics. I think there are a lot of people in both parties that are frustrated and not happy with the nominees in either party, quite frankly. And I think sometimes the Democrats nominate somebody that only appeals to a small slice of the Democratic Party. The Republicans may nominate somebody that appeals to a small slice over here. And about 80% of the rest of us in the middle are frustrated. And I think we got to do a better job. It's very disappointing that we can't win elections. But look, governors all across America, we have 31 Republican governors. Unlike in Washington where nothing gets done, we have to govern every day. We make decisions. We make things happen. That's what people in America want. So first of all, we ought to be electing a governor as the nominee. And second,
I would agree with that. I like governors.
Instead of somebody in Washington that just argues all the time and absolutely gets nothing done. I really do think that the process is skewed so that the Democrats appoint somebody that's too liberal and the Republicans appoint somebody that's too conservative, and most voters are disappointed.
Not so much this year, but that's a different story. I will say this, maybe on the first part, not so much the second. In all seriousness, though, this is what we have to understand. This is our responsibility. If we don't like it, it's our fault. This is a government of and by and for the people, and we are increasingly disengaged. We are increasingly cynical. We are increasingly jaded. We increasingly don't show up to vote because it might be raining outside. We don't encourage our children and our grandchildren to take this seriously, and we are squandering the greatest noble experiment that has ever been foisted upon the world of politics in the history of the world, and we are wasting it because we're not engaged. And we have an obligation, frankly, to step up. Every single one of us, regardless of whether you're on the right or the left, if you don't care as much as the people who stepped off transport carriers on Omaha Beach, if you don't care as much as the people who ate their shoes at Valley Forge in the winter of 1776, and you say you want a better America and you want a better whatever state you're in, and you don't care even some small percentage of that, you don't deserve it. We don't deserve it. The truth be told, we have got to step up. We have an obligation to sacrifice in some form or fashion. We really do. And so if only 50% or less of us in primaries, the nominees come out of primaries. And primaries have 30, 28, 37% of the people bother to vote, and only 6 of 10 people that are eligible to vote or even registered to vote. What are we doing about it? What are any of you doing about making sure that you get your friends, neighbors, and families to be engaged, to be registered, and actually be informed? One of the dangers our founding fathers warned us, one of the dangers of a democratically elected government, and granted we're a republic, but we elect democratically, and one of the dangers is eventually you get the government you deserve. And this is where we are.
Let me ask other questions. Right here, sir. Here's a microphone right over here.
This is a little off topic, but concern to us out here. I'm Carl Stetcher from the Denver suburbs. Governor Hogan. The Calvert Cliffs project has been a nuclear facility giving power to Maryland for a long time. In the West, we're very concerned because they're building wind farms that take up acreage, solar farms that are burning birds that fly over, and so on. How successful is that? Do you have any other plans? And could you talk about the arguments that are going back and forth regarding nuclear power versus solar and wind?
Sure. Well, it's most of the argument that we're having in our state, the Calvert Cliffs nuclear plant and we're exporting natural gas as well, about $8 billion worth to Japan and other places that we're taking out of the same, just down the street from Calvert Cliffs. So we're doing natural gas, we're doing nuclear, we're doing wind and solar, but there are some folks from other places in the country who have come to protest that, but it's overwhelmingly popular in our state. They do a good job, they've never had any problems, it's good, clean energy, and you know, people are looking for, I'm an all-of-the-above energy guy. We ought to try everything that makes sense, but it's got to make economic sense. And those projects do, and they're going to be very successful.
How's the coal in Kentucky, Governor Bivens?
The energy landscape is changing. We all know that. Coal is under duress. But there's never been in the history of the world more coal consumed than there is now. They're building coal-fired power plants the world over. They're building 18 brand-new coal-fired power plants as we speak in Europe, six of them in Germany, using the pioneer technology that we've developed in terms of new technologies for burning and scrubbing. And so everywhere but in America, where we have an abundance of it, it is still providing more than 35% of the world's electricity. In this country alone, it's more than a third, probably more than that globally. In the lifetimes of those in this room, while the energy of the future may not involve it, the bridge from where we are to whatever that future looks like is going to be built out of coal of necessity. And so we've got to, again, be mindful of the fact that if you don't want rolling brownouts, why are they building six brand-new coal-fired power plants in Germany? Because 2 winters ago, when they had a tough winter, they were having rolling brownouts in Germany, and they weren't having electricity on demand, and they weren't having heat on demand, and they didn't want to be held hijacked by Gazprom, which supplies 30-plus percent of the energy to Europe through the Ukraine from Russia. These things matter. There is geopolitical impact associated with us vilifying certain energy sources. I'm a big believer in free markets. I'm also an all-of-the-above guy. But if we have to subsidize something with our tax dollars in order to justify its existence, I'm not sure it's a good bet.
Another question, please. Right back there.
First of all, I want to thank you for today. It's been very informative. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. But I'm a very well-educated, involved citizen, and I must say that I don't know what the truth is with this whole election going on. If I turn on CNN, I get one set of numbers and one set of story. Turn on Fox News, I get another. I have to go to a fact check, and I'm still not sure. How do we make the informed decisions, as you were talking about, and get involved and get friends involved if we don't really feel we know the truth? That, I think, is so imperative.
I'll let the governors answer, but let me insert one thing. There's a very fine piece in the Wall Street Journal today, if I can just mention maybe what you're getting at, both because of the Bernie rise and the Trump rise. A lot of people have been saying, what are the American people trying to tell us? And this article says, unfortunately, it's hard to get there. When ordinary people with concerns about the future for themselves and their families are hectored and lectured about how loathsome they are. The writer goes on to quote the playwright Bertolt Brecht, who said, would it not be easier in that case for the government to dissolve the people and elect another?
And while we laugh, I mean, to the heart of your question, that's true enough. And we were joking earlier that, frankly, there's many in Washington that would probably wish they could do that. What we have seen is a government of and by and for the people rearing its head in a way that we haven't. So what is the truth? I mean, the truth be told, if you think that what you get in what passes for media is actually the lay of the land, I would encourage you to think otherwise. In my race, 2 days before the election, the New York Times came to write the op-ed. They were writing the post-mortem on my campaign. I was down 5%. Every expert, Cook, Sabato, all the crystal balls, all the nonsense, all of them. I wasn't going to win. I was going to lose by 5%. Every poll that had been done, because they created a narrative and they wanted to make it a self-fulfilling one. I won by 9%. It wasn't because I did something magical in 2 days. It wasn't even close. This race is not nearly what you're being led to believe. If you want to understand the truth, if you want to understand, I would ask, in all seriousness, ma'am, I would ask two things. I would ask each of us to look internally and ask ourselves, what do we want? What do we want for our children and our grandchildren? What is it that we value about America? What are we concerned about the potential of losing? And then ask ourselves, what is the greatest threat to the things that we value, to the liberties and the freedoms and the independence? What is the greatest threat to that? And then find solutions to that and choose those individuals that will best serve us in terms of limiting the threats that face the things we value. But I would also encourage each of you in this room, and in a town like Aspen, I mean this with absolute sincerity, talk to the people that shop in the General. Go into a Dollar General. Go into a Walmart and ask the Walmart greeter. I'm not kidding.
Dollar General in
Aspen. Well, I mean, whatever. Go into whatever you got. But I mean, We laugh, but
you'll
I'm
have to go
you,
to Maryland for the
these,
Dollar General.
Ask a police officer, ask a military veteran, ask a firefighter, ask the person. Okay, how about this? Ask the person who removes the chocks from the wheel of your plane when you fly out of here. How about that? Ask these people what's happening. Two things move the markets, and two things move people at the ballot box, and those two things are fear and greed. And right now, fear is more rampant than people will let on. People are fearful, and when people are fearful, they're not answering polls. They're not talking to CNN. You listen to these experts that are on these Sunday morning talk shows. They all live in Washington, D.C., and they all talk with each other every week, and they don't have a clue what's happening out here in the real world. And people are going to be shocked come November. Mark my words. They will.
Yeah. We're running over, so we're gonna stop. But just a final word from Governor Ricketts and Governor Hogan and Governor Bevins, thank you.
Great. What did you want me to give the final word on?
Anything you want. Any final word?
Well, hey again, folks, thank you all very much for having all of us here today. And I think that what I see as a very positive trend is that you have more people like my colleagues up here who are getting involved. You know, people with a business background who understand that government serves an important function, that it's important that it works, and that it's our jobs as governors to make it work. And so you see this all across the country in a way in the last few years that I don't think we've seen much in the past. And again, this is not a Republican-Democrat thing, right? You look at the governor of your own state here has a business background. And that's what I think is encouraging, is that more people who have that experience running other organizations are stepping up into government to say, I can make this work better. I've got the experience to help make government work, because that is what people want. People are frustrated. People don't want known government. Most people are not anarchists, but they're really unhappy with how poorly government is run. And trust me, having been in the office when I saw how things were being functioned, government is appallingly run. And I can't even imagine what it's like at the federal level. But you see more people that have that background in running organizations stepping up and saying, I can make this better, I can make government work, and that's what people want.
Governor Hogan, a final word.
Well, I just want to thank the Aspen Institute for putting on this great event, and thank you for inviting us today. It was wonderful. We appreciate the opportunity, and we've loved being here for a couple of days with the Republican Governors Association. We love the weather. I left, it was like 110 in the Maryland, Washington area, so it's very nice, in spite of the rain. But, you know, I go back to this last question about truth, and I think that's what everybody's looking for. And I believe that people, it doesn't matter where you are in the spectrum, and it doesn't matter if you're a liberal Democrat or a conservative Republican or somebody in between, I think everyone's frustrated that government's not working. They're frustrated that politicians don't tell them the truth, that they can't get the real story on the media. I'm not sure what the solution is, but I think what people are hungry for is people that'll just tell them exactly what they think without the spin and come up with real bipartisan solutions and then say what you're going to do and then do what you said you were going to do. It doesn't happen much in politics. I think it's one of the reasons why we've been successful in Maryland. I have people come up to me and say, I'm a liberal Democrat and I don't really agree with you on a lot of issues, but I think you're telling the truth and you tell it exactly what you think. And I think that's what people want, straight talk. They're tired of the spin, they're tired of the politics. People are frustrated. This election is frustrating so many people because they don't know what the truth is and they're not happy. And this is the first time in my lifetime, a majority of all the people in the country do not like either choice. right? It's true. Any poll you look at, a majority of America does not want to vote for either one of these two candidates. It's the first time I've ever seen it before. Something has to be done. We've got to start nominating people who appeal to a greater percentage of people in America and in our states.
Well, I thank you very, very much. Let me say, it has been a great honor for me to meet these three governors, and I welcome our other governors. If you want the straight truth, what I found is I Googled each of these governors to get ready, and I read their State of the State talk. Get it straight, get it from the people you're following or don't want to follow, but listen to what they say, not anyone else. And I learned a lot, and I have great admiration for each and every one of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.